If you're among the many who are looking for simple, inexpensive ways to bring your family together over the holidays, something that doesn't require expensive technology or a major investment of energy, the next few minutes are for you. Here's NPR's Lynn Neary on one timeless tradition that works as well now as it has for centuries.
It's a cold winter day, not yet 5 o'clock, and already the light has left the sky. But inside the home of Sally and Stephen Kern, the wood-beamed living room is warmly lit, and a fire is burning in the fireplace. Stephen Kern uses an old-fashioned bellows to pump up the blaze. Nearby, 10-year-old Garrett and 7-year-old Larkin play chess while their mom flips through the day's mail.
Oh, we got a card from Mother.
Yeah, I got it.
In the dark days after Thanksgiving, but before the holiday season is in full swing, Sally Kern drags out a big box filled not with decorations, those will come later, but with books. Books filled with stories, mostly about Christmas, but also about Hanukkah and Kwanzaa and the winter solstice. The Kerns read to their kids pretty much every night, but these books are special, read only at this time of year. And as the family picks through the pile, they look for their favorites, the ones they remember from last year.
Which one do you want, Laura?
The one with the boy from Oslo.
The boy from Oslo? Who's that knocking on Christmas Eve?
Mm-hmm. Oh, here it is, Laura.
Sally Kern loves books. When she was a kid, she wanted to be an illustrator, so she chooses her books with the eye of an artist. Intricate, detailed pictures with an old-fashioned look appeal to her. As she takes these books out one by one, she gazes at them fondly and smiles as she recounts the stories inside. These books are her way into the holiday.
I think it's wonderful to have books as a centering activity this time of year, because everything does get really ratcheted up, and even before Thanksgiving, the Christmas pummel starts, and so this is something that's very grounding for them and for us.
Sally pulls her son Lark's favorite book from the pile and hands it to Stephen. Sally may be the collector, but Stephen is the reader.
It's funny, we call this the Snossage book. Everybody knows it's that, but it's Who's That Knocking on Christmas Eve by Jan Brett. High above the Arctic Circle in the land of ice and snow, the northern lights shimmer in the night like a curtain of color hanging from the sky. The air is so crisp and clear in the northern place that one Christmas Eve long ago, a boy from Finnmark on his way to Oslo with his ice bear could see smoke curling up from a hut far in the distance. He was cold and hungry, so he headed towards it.
As Stephen reads, 7-year-old Larkin snuggles next to him on the couch. His older brother Garrett prowls around the room or pokes at the fire, but listens intently to the story. By now, Garrett is old enough to read a lot of these books himself.
I like North Country Christmas and An Orange for Frankie. These are two of my favorites.
How many of these books have you read yourself versus...
I've read everyone you've read to me myself, and I've read some others myself.
When do you read these? I didn't know you were reading these yourself.
Whenever I get the chance.
Do you like being read to?
Yeah, because when I'm going through the books, I'm just reading them for fun, and just when I'm listening to them, I get more out of it because I listen to stuff that I don't notice when I'm just skimming through the pages.
As much as kids enjoy being read to, some parents feel self-conscious when they read aloud, says Judy Freeman, author of Books Kids Will Sit Still For, A Guide to Read Aloud Books. Freeman says parents should get over their inhibitions.
Your kids don't know the difference. They just want to be warm, and they want to hear your voice, and they want to associate the words with you. It turns them into readers. If you want your kid to read, you need to read to them.
Reading aloud to kids is a good idea no matter what time of year, says Freeman, but the holidays can be an incentive to get started.
When you start a family tradition by reading the same books every year, pulling them out every year, making it into something that you think about every year, it's just fun. It's warm. It makes you say, oh, it's that time of year again. Let's do this.
Over the years, the Kerns have discovered that the annual ritual spawns their own stories, which are now becoming part of their family legend.
What's this one?
This was a present last year. Christmas Day in the Morning by Pearl S. Buck. Do you remember this?
I do.
You cried last year when you read this.
I did.
You had a little tear.
You don't remember that?
You know, it's nice to have Sally to remind me of these things.
Stephen seems almost surprised at how deeply this tradition has taken hold in his family. We don't really analyze it, he says. It's just something we do. And the more the Kearns do it, the more it becomes something they can't do without.
I like it that, we really don't bring these books out until after Thanksgiving, and they really do go away again. And it's actually a bit hard to put them away because, as you can see, we have a lot of books. We don't get through them all. But I think that sort of is part of the looking forward to taking them out again and rediscovering them and maybe adding a new one.
Sally looks forward to the time when the kids will be old enough for bigger books like A Christmas Carol, which her grandfather and her mother remember being read to them as children. And there's one book the Kearns read every year without fail.
We read The Night Before Christmas, The Night Before Christmas. And sometimes that's at home, and sometimes that's in a rustic lodge in West Virginia beside the frozen river.
But this year, on this night, the Kearns get a sneak preview of the big event as Stephen picks up the book Sally's parents gave her as a present many years ago and begins to read.
'Twas the night before Christmas when all through the house not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse. The stockings were hung by the chimney with care in hopes that St. Nicholas soon would be there.
Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
The children were nestled all snug in their beds while visions of sugar plums danced in their heads. And Mama in her kerchief and I in my cap had just settled our brains for a long winter's nap.
We have a list of seasonal books, books you might want to read with your family, at npr.org. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montagne.
You know, it takes the gifts of a novelist to fathom the Governor Rod Blagojevich story this week. Fortunately, we can now turn to a novelist who's also a former federal prosecutor in Chicago, my friend Scott Turow, author of many best-selling novels. He's working on a sequel to his book, Presumed Innocent. He joins us from Chicago. Scott, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome, Scott. How are you?
Fine, thanks. You were Governor Blagojevich's first appointment to the Illinois Executive Ethics Commission.
I was.
Could he be? Could
probably going to end up being one of the most dubious distinctions of my career.
Let me ask you, you have a governor apparently recorded referring to a Senate seat as saying, quote, "I've got this thing and it's bleeping golden. I'm just not giving it up for bleeping nothing."
Right.
But that obviously sounds explicit. But is the legal case that clear cut?
Well, you know, if Hillary Clinton had ended her campaign, her presidential campaign, in exchange for a promise from Barack Obama that she would be his vice presidential candidate, nobody would be talking about a federal prosecution.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, if Governor Blagojevich was really looking for an appointment to the Obama cabinet, which, parenthetically, I have to say, is insane because the guy was radioactive. There was no way anybody about to get indicted was going to be appointed to anything.
Yeah, they wouldn't even let him speak at the convention this
right.
summer.
Yeah. I mean, there's absolutely no chance that that was going to happen, and almost all of the governor's activities indicate that he was badly out of touch with reality.
Mm-hmm.
But to go back to the question, you know, I don't think looking for an appointment is necessarily a crime only because he can argue that somehow that's serving the public interest. But when it comes down to matters of personal profit, like campaign contributions in exchange for a specific act or a high-paying job in the private sector, then it's pretty clear-cut that, yes, the line has been crossed.
Speaking as a former prosecutor, did Mr. Fitzgerald, please spring the trap before the governor's tail was in it?
He had to. He had no choice. I think that, you know, the debate is large around Chicago about exactly what it was that the U.S. attorney was afraid was going to happen if the governor stayed in office unconfined, as it were, another 30 seconds. But there were a number of things. There were bills on his desk. Everyone is aware that he had met with Jesse Jackson Jr. on Monday. There apparently had been fundraiser on Saturday, on the prior Saturday, involving Jackson and Blagojevich supporters. And whatever it was, the U.S. attorney clearly was afraid that a public act by the governor of enormous consequence was about to take place, for which he, Fitzgerald, would only be criticized if he allowed it to take place. So he did what he really had to do. And I have to say, you know, and sometimes I criticize Pat Fitzgerald, sometimes I compliment him, but certainly as a prosecutor, he has demonstrated a strong inclination not to interfere with the political process. And so I think it's really clear that he did what he had to do before his case was fully ripe.
Novelist and former federal prosecutor Scott Durow. Scott, thanks so much for being with us.
You're more than welcome, Scott. Good to talk with you always.
I am Neda Ulibi. This week on NPR's podcast, Book Tour, we're joined by author Margaret Atwood, reading from her new collection of essays about debt.
Debt is the new fat, someone said recently, which led me to reflect that not so long ago, fat was the new cigarette smoking. And before that, cigarette smoking was the new alcohol drinking. And before that, alcohol drinking was the new whoremongering. And whoremongering is the new debt. And so we go in circles.
To hear the entire reading and discussion, and to hear other authors of fiction and nonfiction reading from their work, visit npr.org/booktour.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. They say it takes a village to raise a child, but maybe you just need a few moms in your corner. We visit with a diverse group of parents each week for their common sense and savvy parenting advice. Today, we want to continue a conversation we had last week about parenting books. Last week, we invited two very different authors, both men, to talk about their two newly published books. But we decided that the whole issue of parenting books deserved more attention, especially as the holidays approach and books are always a popular gift. So we decided to ask two of our mom's regulars to look on their shelves for their favorite books. Jolene Ivey, a regular Tell Me More contributor, is co-founder of the Mocha Moms, a parenting support group, and Dia Michaels, who also works in the publishing industry, decided to share the books that they thought should be on every parent's gift list.
Hey, Michelle.
Thanks, Michelle.
Jolene, what do you look for in a parenting book?
I look for something that makes sense, that doesn't dictate to me this is how you should raise your child, but more, here are some observations, here are some philosophies, here are some things you can look for. I don't believe that somebody else knows better than I do, generally speaking, how to raise my child.
So tone is very important to
you.
Very
important.
If it takes this kind of didactic, this is how it is, believe it, or get the hell out kind of approach, you're not interested.
I won't pass that along to anyone.
So one of your suggestions is T. Barry Brazelton's Infants and Mothers, Differences in Development.
Yes, I really like this book. It's a classic, and what I appreciate about it is he definitely says the mother knows best about her child. She knows what's going on with her kid. If there's something wrong, he says trust your instincts. And he takes three different children and watches their development for a year. So month by month, you get to hear about a quiet child, an active child, and an average child. That way, when you are a new mom and you don't know what you're doing, you don't feel confident, you see that your kid fits somewhere in the continuum of what is normal. You don't think there's something weird wrong with your child because he's doing something faster or slower than other children.
But what if there is something
well,
wrong
you know,
that demands attention? Sometimes there are developmental markers that are really important to bring to the attention
absolutely.
Of a professional. So it can work both ways. So
yeah.
Trusting your instincts also doesn't mean ignoring professional
absolutely.
Advice. Dia, what do you look for in a parenting book? And I should mention that your company, Platypus Media, publishes them, but none of the books you're recommending today are published by your imprint. So I just want to be sure that everybody knows
right.
that.
Right.
So what do you look for in a book for yourself as a mom and also to publish?
What's important to me is that the book not have a dogmatic tone. I don't want anyone telling me that unless I do this, there'll be dire consequences. So it's important to me that the author is a relaxed author, that they tell me, you know, how to think about something, how to phrase something. And even more important than that, I want the book grounded in science. I want it looked at from a child development point of view. I don't just want someone's opinion.
I want to play a short clip from our conversation last week where I asked you about the two books we were talking about. One of the books was by Steve Doocy. He's the author of Tales from the Dad Side. It's a kind of a memoir about his time as a parent. We also had on author Brett Burke, who wrote The Gay Uncle's Guide to Parenting. Dia, your reaction to Brett's book. Let's just say when I ask if you liked the book, well, let's just listen.
Uh-oh, that's a long pause.
That's a long pause.
We may have to retape that.
That's just a little piece of the exchange, but Dia, clearly there was something that you were hating. So what was it?
Well, actually, I'm glad you asked that because I've had a week to think about it. I think what bothered me about the book is that it was all his opinion. And one of the things that Brett said in his book, in the breastfeeding section, is that he has a rule about breastfeeding. 2 breasts, 2 years. Well, it's a nice alliteration. It may work for some people. But the fact of the matter is, some children are perfectly happy weaning early, and some are perfectly happy continuing longer. And the rule in breastfeeding is, as long as it's mutually compatible for mom and baby. So I don't need someone who's never breastfed, who's never studied breast milk, and who's never looked into the science of human lactation saying 2 breasts, 2 years.
Well, I will say, though, he does have 2 degrees in early childhood development. He's been the head of a preschool. He has extensive experience working with young children, but he's not a parent, and he's certainly not a woman. But is that what pushes your buttons? I mean, do you feel that, is it more the tone? I don't want to pick him because he's not here,
right.
So I don't want to spend too much time on that. But is it? But just over, I guess what I'm saying, overall, what is it that you feel puts you off? Is it tone? Is it matching credentials to the topic at hand? Or you feel that if you're not a mom, you should just stay out of some areas altogether?
No, I feel like you should know what you're talking about other than being your opinion. So, for instance, Brett's book, like many, many others, has the dire consequences. If your baby's not off the bottle at 1, not out of a stroller by 2, not out of diapers by 3, not finished, thumb sucking, then X, Y, and Z will go wrong. So having rules about these things and being told that there's something wrong with you if you're not following the rules really bothers me.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm speaking with Jolene Ivey and Dia Michaels, the moms, about parenting books that they think should make your gift list. So you had your reservations about last week's picks. I'm going to defend them, though. I still thought they were really interesting. I personally think that you should always take these books with a grain of salt, just because I think, like Jolene said, you've got to see what makes sense to you within the context of your culture, within the context of the culture of your family, and so forth. But let's hear one of yours. You have a classic, Our Babies, Ourselves, How Biology and Culture Shape the Way We Parent. What do you like about this book?
Oh, I love this book. This book was written by an evolutionary biologist, Meredith Small. She's up at Cornell. And what she does is she says Western parents parent very, very differently than the entire rest of the world. It's really fascinating to think about. It comes down to one word, and that word is crying. What do people do when the baby cries? And you have, the Dr. Ferbers of the world that tell you to ignore it. We have Dr. Watson was a famous child advice person before Dr. Spock came on the scene. And he said, ignore your child's cries. And so the question is, what is crying signaling and how do parents respond? Now, babies cry for the same reason adults cry. Babies cry either because they are hurt physically or emotionally, or they need something. And so do we interpret that as the baby's trying to manipulate us and we have to put that baby in its place? Or do we interpret that as this is the time to respond? And what you find in other cultures is babies don't cry. And in those cultures, there are 4 things that distinguish them. All families co-sleep, so the baby's never sleeping alone. Babies are carried all the time. Babies are picked up whenever they have any distress. And babies breastfeed at will. I find it fascinating seeing how other cultures work, how they solve problems. And the step beyond the crying is the village, that women in other cultures aren't raising children alone, and they have the resources, the people, and the support to see how children are raised and how to respond.
Okay. Actually, what I'm hearing from you two say is that really there is no book that should be on every parent's gift list, because every book is not for every parent. Is that right, Jolene?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And another one I'd like to give a little print to today, so to speak, is the MOCA manual. It is by Kimberly Seals Allers. And what I love about this book is it gives some attention to things going on in the African American community as far as health disparities, how the different kinds of health care treatment you're going to get depending on your race. And how, since it's so different, Black women need to be aware, when they're pregnant especially, different steps they need to take and stay on top of things, because their doctor may not pay attention to the same things for that person. Maybe not intentionally, but statistically, that's what happens.
Dia, what's your other book that you
want
to recommend?
Well, I wanted to disagree with something you did say, which is there is no book that should be on everyone's shelf, because we need books, because we don't have the huge village and we don't have access to all the information. So I picked The Baby Book, Everything You Need to Know About Your Baby from Birth to Age 2 by Dr. William Sears. And the book is so warm and friendly, but there are things parents don't know. When should their child be walking? When do you start solid foods? When do you call the emergency room? And I think it's important to have a book that's readable and friendly that you can look up. I mean, The Baby Book, it is thick. It's, what, 2 inches thick? But it's got everything that you need, because babies don't come with instructions.
Neither one of you still has an infant or a baby, a young child at home. Do you still find yourself looking at parenting books at this stage of your lives as parents?
I have to admit that I really don't, not anymore. I mean, boy, I've got a 19-year-old and a 9-year-old almost. I've got 3 in between those two. If I don't know how to raise kids at this point, I don't know what to do. But, you know, beyond that, I think that it's one of the things I'm good at.
I have one to throw in to the list, if I may. It's called Becoming Dad, Black Men and the Journey to Fatherhood. It's by the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Leonard Pitts, Jr., and it's a collection of essays by and about the experience of African-American fathers. And I think this is the kind of book. Now, I'm African-American, but I'm not a man, and I'm not a father. But I found it so moving and so... It's just very hard for me to describe how powerful it was to understand just how deeply many men care about being a father and how much it means to them to try to get it right, whatever that means. And I just think that there are not a lot of works that really honor the role of father in the way that this does, and also talks about the real world struggles. So I think this book is particularly meaningful to African-American men, and also I think perhaps Latino men. But I think many men would relate to this book and the way it honors the role and also doesn't shy away from the very real challenges
Michelle,
of being a father.
Don't tell Glenn, but that's actually something that's on my Christmas list to get for him, because I've heard about that book. I hear it's fabulous. And I really think that even though he is also a father with a lot of experience under his belt, this is one that I think would kind of reaffirm him as a father. It might make him feel good to read.
So you want me to not tell him?
Don't tell him. He doesn't listen. He doesn't have time to listen to the radio.
What's it worth to you? Just kidding. Jolene Ivey and Dia Michaels joined us from our studios in Washington. They're two of our mom's regulars. Dia Michaels is also the founder and president of Platypus Media, which publishes parenting books. But I want to emphasize, none of the titles we talked about today are published by her imprint. We will have all of these parenting picks on our website, which you can find at the Tell Me More page at npr.org. Ladies, moms, thank you again.
Thanks, Michelle.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And as we said, if you missed the mom's recommendations, don't worry. We have a list as well as last week's picks on our website, the Tell Me More page at npr.org.
A professor at MIT likes to ask her students to recall a moment very early in their lives. It's a moment when they began to think like scientists. The students answer by writing essays, which Professor Shelley Turkle has collected for 25 years. She recently published a selection of them, including one from a student who went on to a career as a computer scientist, and her essay caught the eye of NPR's Robert Krulwich.
One day, when computer scientist Erica Carmel was just 5 years old,
I was in our playroom at home, and I had this egg basket that was clearly from an Easter basket with those little plastic eggs.
And Erica decided that what she wanted to do right then was to recreate a Disneyland experience.
I think I had been in Disneyland recently with my grandparents, and they had the nice gondola.
You know, that ski lift thing that takes you up in the air on wires so you can then look down at Fantasyland and down at Frontierland. So Erica, she looked at her jump rope and at her Easter basket
and decided to create a gondola. So took jump rope, tied it to the doorknob, and
stretched that rope.
Yes.
All the way across her playroom to a bookshelf on the opposite wall.
Climbed up on the top of the bookshelf, tied it to the top of the bookshelf, which of course parents loved me doing.
And now with the rope
at a slant?
Yes.
She takes the egg basket, she hangs it onto the rope, lets it go, and of course
it slides down to the other side of the room. So at that point, that worked. Which probably made it less exciting.
Then, because she's a little bored, she took the rope in her hands and she thought,
you know, yeah, it would be fun to make it go back and forth.
So she began to swing the rope.
And I get the basket swinging.
Side to side.
Back and forth.
Gently at first.
Back and forth. A little bit higher. Back and forth. A little bit higher. Back and forth.
And why not? She gives it a real swing.
And
the basket makes a complete turn up and over.
All the way around the rope.
360.
With the eggs in.
With the eggs in.
And amazingly, the eggs don't fall out.
Which is very, very surprising.
Did you do it a second time?
Did a second and a third time.
The eggs stayed in every time?
Yes. And then, of course, I had to try it the other way to make sure that they really should have fallen out. So I take the basket, untie it, put the eggs in, turn it upside down, and sure enough, the eggs fell out. I had discovered something. Whatever it was that made things fall no longer applied when you made them move around in circles.
Can you remember what that felt like when you were the first person in the entire world to know about this secret thing about eggs in baskets?
Oh, incredible. Such excitement, which is why I still remembered it 20 years later. Just that sheer excitement. So I run out of the room.
Clearly she had to tell somebody about this.
Dad, I discovered this magical force, and I think I probably dragged him into the room. And he kind of looked at me like, okay, what is it that you discovered?
Did you realize that you were not the first at that moment, or were you just puzzled by his unexcitement?
No, at that point, I was crushed. I was crushed.
Okay, skip forward 13 years. Now Erica Carmel is in college.
Yes, so I end up at MIT. I'm taking physics, which every single member of the freshman class is taking, with Walter Lewin.
Walter Lewin is one of those legendary physics teachers famous for bringing a bucket filled with water for his demonstration of centrifugal force.
So he's got his pail of water, and he starts to swing it back and forth, higher and higher and higher, and then his arm goes in a full circle, and the pail goes completely upside down, and sure enough, the water stays in the pail.
And you are thinking,
I knew that.
Even though at 17 she could admit centrifugal force was not really my discovery?
It is still my discovery.
Because?
Because I made the discovery myself.
Robert Grulwich, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
For more about these and other books, visit our website, npr.org/books.